Today, how UK scientists are tracking down new COVID variants. Right now, it feels like there's a lot to be optimistic about. COVID case numbers are falling, millions of people have been vaccinated, and we can all finally get a haircut.
Oh.
But across London, surge testing is currently taking place to contain an outbreak of the South African COVID variant discovered in Lambeth last week. And yesterday, the Health Secretary Matt Hancock revealed that 103 cases of an Indian variant have been discovered in this country, the majority of which have been linked to travel. The reason I can tell you this is because since the pandemic began, a team of proverbial COVID detectives have been working to track variants as they appear to try and stop them from spreading. The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, has been speaking to some of them to find out how they identified the B117 variant, a strain which we all became very familiar with last December when it forced us to cancel our Christmas plans and ushered in the UK's third lockdown. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, a COVID detective story, hunting for new variants. Sarah Bosley, let's go back to the end of our last lockdown on the 2nd of December. We'd been living with tough restrictions for 4 weeks and COVID infection rates were falling, except in Kent, where they were going up. Can you tell me exactly where this was happening? And was there something about these places that may have indicated why this was happening?
The places in Kent where the numbers were rising noticeably were Swale and Thanet. And those are two areas on the coast of Kent, either side of Canterbury. They are really England's orchards, apple orchards, plum orchards, even some hop gardens. So a lot of it's rural and they are coastal towns, so they have lots of people who go there to retire. And they had the highest infection rates in the country.
When this happens, when there is a spike in cases in a certain area, what is the response? Who began investigating this?
Well, to begin with, there was a lot of discussion locally about what was going on, because obviously local authorities get the figures. And nationally as well, newspapers start to point fingers.
The precise reason for the high infection rate in Swale still isn't clear, but some who've studied the data point to the three prisons on Sheppey as a potential contributory factor.
It was remarkable.
It's a behavioural problem. If it is spreading very rapidly during this period of time, then people perhaps in their workplace or at home or coming out of school, they are not distancing.
Locally, there were meetings. The Swale council leader said at an emergency meeting that they had reports of crowding in supermarkets. They were going to supercharge the messaging, telling people that they had to follow the rules. So you can see that there did begin to be quite a lot of bad feeling about what was happening in Kent, and people were being blamed.
Well, one thing that some areas of society have been very good at through this pandemic, Sarah, is pointing the finger at, say, large crowds in parks or people in supermarkets and suggesting that's why case numbers go up. But there are other reasons, aren't there? Who else was investigating why there might be an increase in cases in this part of Kent?
Any sort of outbreak is immediately of concern to Public Health England. There are public health officials in all the boroughs, all the district authorities. So it was those people to begin with who would have been looking at the numbers and asking questions and trying to find out what was going wrong. I spoke to Dr. Christina Atchison, who heads the Rapid Investigation Unit. So she was the first on the scene.
And so with the local team, we sort of did a deep dive. I mean, Swale and Thanet are quite deprived areas. We know that transmission tends to be higher in those areas.
And what did Christina manage to find? What did she tell you about what she was looking for and what she came across in those early days?
She said there were lots of hypotheses. You know, maybe this is about commuters. People commute into London and back again. But it didn't really make a lot of sense. You know, there wasn't a massive outbreak in London that anybody could pinpoint. They also thought about the local industries to see what sort of factories they have.
They've got quite a lot of agriculture and they have a lot of migrant communities that perhaps sort of live in sort of more sort of close quarters.
She, in the end, couldn't find any really good convincing reason why the cases were going up in that area. So she decided that actually they ought to take a look at the genomics.
Okay, so they'd gathered quite a lot of information and at this point decided genomic data could help understand this rise in cases. Can you help me understand, Sarah, what information that would give the team at Public Health England? What would this tell them about what was going on potentially?
Genomic sequencing is looking at the genetic fingerprint of the virus. You want to see how it's structured, how it's made up, and whether in any way the sample of virus that you've got is different from other samples that you've seen in the past. And viruses mutate all the time. The COVID virus changes about a couple of times a month, something like that across the world, which is quite slow for a virus. Flu mutates much faster than that. So genomic sequencing enables us to see whether any changes are taking place that actually could make it more lethal or spread faster. And both of those things we would be very worried about.
Right. So genomic sequencing tells us how a virus is made and how it changes. And as a country, we're pretty good at this, aren't we?
We have a long history of enthusiasm, I suppose you'd say, for genomic sequencing. And that perhaps goes back, you know, right to the discovery of DNA and the sequencing of DNA by Fred Sanger, which led to the naming of the Sanger Institute that we have now. And that's going back to the 1950s.
And the big challenge now is to see if you can use this knowledge to prevent diseases and to make life happier.
We've just been very convinced that genomic sequencing was a good thing. So when, in fact, the COVID pandemic began, shortly afterwards, we started something called COG UK. And that's a consortium that involves the Sanger Institute and also a dozen universities, which have these labs where they can do a lot of genomic sequencing. So all the people involved in those institutions are busy sequencing as many virus samples as they can get from the tests that people do when they're concerned that they may have COVID. And sequencing all that virus enables them to construct what they call a phylogenetic tree, which is like a family tree, just shows you how the virus is changing as time goes on.
Okay, so when they looked at the genomics of these cases in Kent, what did they find?
What was really different about the Kent samples was that they found a whole load of changes to the virus, not just one or two, but actually 23 mutations. That really made everybody sit up. They couldn't quite believe it. I spoke to Meera Chand about this, the incident director, who's a microbiologist as well, and she said it was quite an unusual looking situation. And they saw that about half the genomes available for Kent belonged to this one huge cluster.
They all look really similar to each other.
Right.
And then they were at the end of what's called a long branch. So remember, they've had lots of mutations since the last thing that we sequenced in that part of the tree.
Yeah.
I mean, even to me, someone who doesn't fully understand a lot of this, Sarah, that sounds very worrying. When did scientists then start to become concerned about what was happening in Kent?
So Meera Chand took this information and what Christina had found to the Tuesday group that she runs. And this is a collection of genomic specialists and enthusiasts, actually. They are scientists who get together by video link every Tuesday and just discuss what the virus is up to and whether there are things that need to be investigated.
And what did they discuss? How did it go down?
So on the 8th of December, the Tuesday group met, and as soon as they started to look at this genomic data, all of the scientists in the group realised that there was something important going on here that they really needed to get to the bottom of, and quickly.
Oh, this really looks like something we haven't seen before. It's bad epidemiology. It's really weird looking genomes. There are lots of them. It seems to be growing quite fast. And all of that together just feels a bit worrying.
Mm. When did this knowledge get shared outside that group?
So that was Tuesday. On Friday, NERVTAG was meeting. That's the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group. Rather a mouthful. It's part of SAGE. So at the meeting was Professor Neil Ferguson. And he immediately saw the relevance of this information and was particularly concerned about the transmissibility. Some work had been done on that by one of the scientists, which suggested it could be 50 to 70% more transmissible than the virus we were already dealing with. So as soon as the meeting was over, he got out his phone and texted Patrick Vallance, who's the government's chief scientific officer, and said, look, this is something we have to watch.
I mean, that must not have been a great text for Patrick Vallance to get, because I'm thinking back to sort of 11th of December, you know, we were all excited for Christmas, weren't we?
Yes, I think everybody involved in this by now, early December, was getting really worried.
By this point then, Sarah, scientists and public health experts have established that the genome sequence of the virus in Kent is very odd, and the prevalence of cases there makes them think that it could also be more infectious, more transmissible. But how did they go about proving that? It turned out that there were others who'd been working on this puzzle, hadn't there?
Well, the Sanger Institute were getting a sample of tests every week from all the lighthouse labs around the country. And those are the big testing centres that were set up by the government. I spoke to Dr. Geoffrey Barrett, who said that they had noticed that actually in Kent, it looks strange. Again, you could see these clusters of mutations.
What we're looking for was suddenly in one place, a lot of really identical viral genomes, which suggests that there's a lot of spread happening from one source, for example, all at once.
But something else was going on as well. The Lighthouse Labs contacted the Sanger to say, when we're doing COVID tests, we're looking for three genes. And it's generally referred to as three green lights. So if all three green lights show up, you know that person's got COVID. Now, instead of that, they were finding that some tests and an increasing number of tests were showing two green lights and a red. The person still had COVID, but it was a different pattern. There was one gene missing, and they referred to this as the S gene target failure.
So instead of like 1% of all tests having two positives, one negative, it's going up to 5%, 10%. And I compared them to the analysis we were doing and said, oh gosh, these are all B117.
Dr. Geoffrey Barrett told me that what that showed up was a way to track the variant, because this was very unusual. These people did have COVID, but having this pattern of green, green and red meant that they could see around the country where it was popping up without having to sequence the virus at all.
It's like half of all PCR tests in Britain are using this technology. So we suddenly had this extremely up-to-date and comprehensive picture of how fast B117 was spreading. We all came to the same conclusion, which was, this is more transmissible, it is going to spread very fast unless restrictions are brought in.
And this was at a time when the government was making big promises to all of us that we could all mix with our families over the festive season. I remember Boris Johnson told us all to have a jolly, careful Christmas.
It is the season to be jolly, but it is also the season to be jolly careful, especially with elderly relatives.
When was the decision made to break this very bad bit of news to the government?
Well, in fact, the whole thing happened with extraordinary speed, and you can imagine how intense it was for the scientists at that time. If you think that the Tuesday meeting where they first discussed this was the 8th of December, then they told NERVTAG that Friday, and on the 14th of December, Matt Hancock told the House of Commons,
over the last few days, thanks to our world-class genomic capability in the UK, we have identified a new variant of coronavirus which may be associated with the fastest spread in the southeast of England.
Then 4 days later, on the 18th, NERVTAG met again to discuss the variant and noted its exponential growth. Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty and the Prime Minister were all briefed, and on Saturday, the 19th of December, Boris Johnson announced that London, the southeast, and the east of England would enter Tier 4 with non-essential shops closed.
NERVTAG's early analysis suggests the new variant could increase the R by 0.4 or more, and although there's considerable uncertainty, it may be up to 70% more transmissible than the old variant, the original version of the disease.
And then Christmas, for most of us, was cancelled. Finally, on the 4th of January, Johnson announced a full national lockdown.
Coming up, could new variants halt the progress made by our vaccine rollout? Looking back to that Christmas period, Sarah, it was pretty traumatic for everyone, wasn't it? I remember you and I making an episode after the Prime Minister's announcement about the variant, and we were only just getting our heads around what was happening. I remember there was a nerve tag document that we referred back to, but there wasn't an awful lot that we knew about the variant at the time. As we emerge from months of lockdown, are we able to determine how big a role the, as we now call it, B117 variant has played in the huge number of deaths and hospitalisations that we've seen in the last few months?
The variant now is the dominant form of this virus in this country. And because of the transmissibility and possibly a slight increase in lethality as well, we've actually seen more deaths in this part of the pandemic than we did in the first wave. I'm not sure that we believed in it as we now have to. I think maybe some people thought it was political cover as much as anything for the failure to lock down earlier. It's been quite a lesson for everybody, I think.
Scientists have been able then to track the spread of this variant, but one thing that is much harder to do is find out where it originated from. What work has been done to try and find patient zero?
Obviously, it's a really good idea to see if you can find where the variant came from, you know, what happened, so that you can stop it happening again, essentially. So there have been efforts. Christina Acheson went to interview the people who were the first ones whose virus samples showed up this variant. We know that those two people, one was in Kent and one was in East London, were tested on the 20th and on the 21st of September. Gosh. So quite some time before anybody knew that this variant existed.
Yeah, quite far back.
But she didn't find anything about them that was particularly significant in terms of how the variant might have emerged. For instance, one of the things that scientists have been watching for is whether we might have an animal-derived outbreak here as a result of the amount of COVID there's been in the mink farms, for instance, in Denmark.
Health authorities, supported by the military, have begun culling the country's entire population of up to 17 million mink after a mutation of coronavirus found in the animals spread to humans.
But these people were not vets, they weren't farmers, and they hadn't travelled abroad. So all of those things meant that they were very unlikely to be the source. There has to be something to trigger the mutation. The virus won't just do it in most people who have COVID. The other thing that they were looking for is whether these early cases actually were patients who had a really weak immune system. If they were immunocompromised, as they say, which might come about because, for instance, they'd had chemotherapy or certain diseases in the past that would have damaged their immune system, then it's possible that they could have had COVID over a long period and the virus in their body might mutate. That has been seen to happen. Professor Ravi Gupta from Cambridge University, who works in Addenbrookes, had a patient who was chronically ill and who had had cancer and chemotherapy and actually had COVID over months and months.
Yeah, I could see he'd been infected for 2 months by then, and I thought, wow, this is quite interesting. The virus must be changing because I couldn't conceive of a viral infection that hangs around for that long and doesn't change.
Eventually, they gave this patient blood plasma, so that's containing the antibodies from people who've recovered from COVID. But when they sequenced the virus that this person had, they found it had changed. It had mutated quite a bit from the original virus.
And that's when we sort of saw these very shocking sort of changes in the virus over time.
And so it can change in a person's body. And they think that plasma and possibly antibody treatments could trigger that. And actually, it is the strongest theory now for the origin of the Kent variant.
What was surprising is to see it transmitted. I mean, you know, at that time, we hadn't really conceived of the fact that these might then spill out into the rest of the population.
But these particular people who were tested early in late September were not immunocompromised either.
The B117 variant has been devastating to us here and around the world. It's thought to be behind Europe's third wave and is now the dominant strain in the US.
Cases are rising fast across continental Europe, driven by what's known as either the Kent or the British variant. A rising tide that the Prime Minister worries will soon reach the UK.
Are other countries as good at picking up on these variants as we are here in the UK?
I think a lot of other countries are now realising how important sequencing is from the British example. So they are beginning to do it as well, a lot more than they did. South Africa has been good at it anyway, which is one of the reasons why we know about the variant that began there. In other places, there may be variants that we don't know about yet because they haven't yet arrived here.
There's been a lot of reporting in the past week, Sarah, about variants that are being detected across the country. Which ones are we seeing crop up here, and how worried should we be about them?
We've seen P1, which is the variant that originated in Brazil, but recently we've had a big surge in B1531, which is the one that came from South Africa in the South London area, in Wandsworth and Lambeth. And surge testing is now going on, which means door-to-door testing and also urging people locally to go to a test centre. We're also seeing for the first time cases of a variant from India, which is of concern because of the huge numbers of cases now occurring in India, where last week on one single day they recorded 200,000 new infections. In terms of how worried we should be, I think we have to be very much on the alert for all these variants because there is a mutation called E484K, for instance, which is in the South African variant and also in P1, the Brazilian variant. And that one does seem to allow the virus to escape the vaccines to some extent. Not totally. So you still have protection. It just isn't going to protect as many people.
There are reports of people in Brazil and India who are being hospitalised with these variants despite having had a vaccine. Is this really bad news, Sarah, for our vaccine rollout here in the UK?
Actually, I think we have to be incredibly careful here, and I don't think it's bad news for our vaccine rollout. I think there are lots of possibilities, and one is that some of these people had contracted the virus before they were vaccinated or in the weeks shortly after, because they don't take effect for at least 3 or 4 weeks, or not full effect. Plus, you have to remember that even a vaccine that's 95% effective is going to protect 95 people, but not the other 5. So there will always be people who are susceptible, which is why you need to get as many people vaccinated as possible, because that drives the levels of virus down. So the possibility of other people getting the virus who haven't been vaccinated is very much diminished. But at the same time, the major manufacturers are actually developing new vaccines. They are tweaking the recipe, if you like, for the ones that we have. And that does mean that they will work against the variants.
Sarah, from speaking to you, it feels like we've learned a lot in this country about variants in this past year. As we continue to open up and potentially look to travel again this summer, are we better prepared to detect and act on new variants than we were last year?
I think we probably are, because there is a recognition now that the scientists did really well over the identification of the B117 variant in Kent. So I don't think they will have any trouble at all in getting all the support they need and all the virus samples they want in order to track down any new variants that might arrive as people start to travel again. So the difficulty is that you're not going to be able to keep variants out, and we need to recognise that. And genome sequencing needs to improve all over the world if possible. In fact, the UK has actually offered to lend its expertise to other countries in order to help that to happen.
Sarah, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
That was Sarah Bosley. Do read her piece about tracking the B117 COVID variant at theguardian.com, where you can also keep up to date on the latest coronavirus developments here and around the world via the live blog. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.